Robert W. Hayes for the appellants. Mr. Hayes has been admitted to this court pursuant to a prior order of pro hoc vitae. Mr. Hayes will be making the argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, this is an appeal from the trial court's denial of indemnity and benefit of the bargain damages to the purchaser of a business on the ground that adjustments to cost reports that were approved by HCFA, the agency responsible for administering the Medicare program, were wrong on each grounds that HCFA adjusted the reports, and that HCFA's own provider reimbursement manual and transmittals were inconsistent with HCFA's own regulations. We submit that the trial court's decision was erroneous on a number of grounds. At an oral argument, of course, other than to address any questions of the court, I would like to focus on the following issues. We submit the court erred in allowing Spherion, the purchaser, to contest the liability for the settlement of NPRs of which it approved and where it had the right to assume interim's defense, the purchased entity, of those NPRs. We submit that the trial court's analysis of the evidence was inconsistent with its own interpretation of the purchase agreement. And we submit that the trial court erred in failing to give due deference that is required under federal law. Compliance with federal law was warranted and represented in the agreement. And that, in that respect, also erred as a matter of law. And lastly, I would address the alternate argument that the court held that there was not a basis to allocate the settlement and therefore interim had not proved its damages. Turning to the settlement issue, we provided this court, we did not find any Delaware authority on point, but we provided this court with Federal Circuit Court authority that holds that where a indemnitor indemnifies a indemnity not only for liability, but also for settlements or claims or demands, that that indemnity extends beyond simply the indemnifying the party if it's held liable in a third-party claim. That indemnity extends to indemnifying that individual or entity for any reasonable and necessary settlement of claims that implicate that party's representations and warranties or other undertakings. And under those circumstances, the courts have held that to obtain indemnity, all that is required is to prove a potential liability on those third-party claims. You do not have to prove that there was actual liability. And in this case, I would highlight for the court that the issues on the NPRs, the Notices of Program Reimbursement, were precisely the same as the issues that were presented on the breach of contract action. HCFA alleged that the cost reports that were submitted prior to the sale were inconsistent with law, with its regulations, its statutes, its provider reimbursement manual, and its transmittals. In this case, the court interpreted the representations and warranties as guaranteeing compliance with those very same provisions. So that if interim was liable under the NPRs, Spherion was liable for breach of warranty. And so therefore, in those circumstances, all that interim had to prove is that its settlement was reasonable and necessary resolution of potential liability, that there was a good grounds for the NPRs that were issued by, ultimately approved by HCFA. And I would submit to the court that if you analyze the contract at issue here, it's clear that Spherion was indemnifying interim and the purchasing parties, what we refer to in the briefs as the cornerstone parties, for more than simply liabilities. The Section 10 provides that Spherion would indemnify the cornerstone parties for any damages resulting from a breach of its representations and warranties. Damages is defined to include settlement costs as well as claims. And settlement costs clearly refers to any amounts paid in settlement, and we provide the court with at least Third Circuit authority that interpreted the word demands as an indemnity for settlements, and I would submit that demands and claims are synonymous. And also, if you look at the contract, the whole structure of it implicates that there would be that Spherion assumes responsibility for any claims that are asserted that implicate breaches of its representations and warranties. It had the right to, under Section 10.6, to assume those defenses. It had the right to approve of any settlement of the claims. It, under the damages provisions, it was responsible for any attorney's fees or other costs that incurred in the, any under such proceedings. The whole structure of it was that if such a claim was made, CNN would then accept responsibility for its indemnity obligations. It could or could not assume the defense. If it did, then it would have control of the proceedings. If it did not, it was responsible for Interim's attorney's fees in defending it, and it had the right to approve the settlement. Once it did that, it could not contest that the settlement was reasonable and necessary, or that there was a potential liability.
Help me to make sure that I understand the record. I understand they didn't assume the defense.
That's correct.
But I'm also under the impression in the record that prior to the consummation of the settlement, they gave notice that they were not going to provide indemnification.
That's correct. But I would stress to the court that their grounds for not providing indemnity was that there was that the representations and warranties had expired before the claims were asserted. Under the contract, there was an 18-month time period beyond the closing for which the representations and warranties would stay in effect. And their argument or their denial of the indemnity obligation was, well, we're not liable because you can't give us notice until you obtain the NPRs are finally issued. And they took that position even though it was conceded that the only reason all of the NPRs were not issued within the 18-month period is that Interim vigorously defended them and convinced HICFA and the fiscal intermediary to review and, in fact, to re-audit, and was able to reduce the claim damages from $40 million to approximately $13 million, at which point...
Am I also correct that in the record reflects when you did get the trial, they adopted an additional position, which is you shouldn't have settled in the first place?
That's correct. I will frankly confess, I don't understand Spirito's position on that. I mean, they argued in their brief that, well, yeah, we consented to the settlement, but that has nothing to do with anything. And I would submit under the clear case law, it does. I mean, under the circuit case law that we provided to you, the right to defend, aside from what the contract itself provides, the right to defend and the right to approve the settlement have independent significance. Because, again, circuit courts of appeal have held, and we cited you to the Eighth Circuit, I believe the Sixth Circuit, probably the Fifth Circuit, and I believe the Third Circuit as well, say that where you have the right to approve a settlement, then you are, whatever legal term you wanted, you're stopped, or you've waived the right or to argue that there was not liability under the claim where you've approved the settlement. For instance, I mean, I won't read to the court, but just think it's such a great statement of it. We cited the court in Burke versus Riff. The reason is that where an indemnitor is notified and can take part and indeed may control litigation, he is precluded from contesting the indemnity's liability in the subsequent indemnity action.
So what were the actual damages? The trial court said that you didn't prove them with specificity.
The settlement was, the total amount paid to the government was $5.2 million. And I would stress to this court, there was no disputed trial that of that figure, $1 million was paid after the first set of NPRs were issued. In other words, to refresh perhaps the court's recollection of the record, initially, NPRs were issued for three of the operating branches, and that's what started the whole dispute with HICFA. But while those were issued, HICFA was taking money from the amounts that should have been paid to Interim, and the total amount was $1 million. The $1 million was solely on 1996 cost reports. There could not be any reasonable issue that fell within Spirion's indemnity obligation. The other $4.2 million was the...
And you argued that to the trial court?
Yes, we did, Your Honor, and we also put that in our brief. On appeal. And secondly, and I think the fact the trial court recognizes that in its opinion. Secondly, the $4.2 is the settlement that was paid to resolve the demands for overpayment for the 1996 through the 1999 time frame. We provided to the trial court a breakdown of what that amount was per year, per provider, pardon me. So that if in fact the court thought there should have been an allocation and said, okay, you're liable for 1996 and 1997 Spherion, I'll apply that percentage of the settlement that bears the same percentage to the amount that was attributable to 1996 and 1997 bears to the total amount claimed. And I'm not sure I said that too clearly, so I'll say it again. The total amount claimed was approximately $13 million. Of that amount, approximately 78% related to the 1996 and 1997 cost years. So we would submit that where the record was clear, Hickford refused to have any discussion of allocation. They just wanted a lump sum payment. And the reason for the settlement, as is reflected even in the settlement agreement with Hickford itself, which is in the record as Exhibit 327, was it was part of the restructuring of Interim. Interim was failing. So in order to allow it to restructure and there was going to be new capital investment, it's cited right in Exhibit 327, Hickford said, all right, we'll reduce the claim from $13 million to $5 million. Under those circumstances, a reasonable assumption is that all the claims were valued equally, and therefore it applied just a percentage of what the 1996 and 1997 cost years bear to the total amount of the reimbursement is a fair means of allocating. And again, what Interim did is it reran these complex cost reports, putting in each adjustment that HICFA had made in order to show its impact. And we not only provided the court with what a year-by-year analysis, but we provided a claim-by-claim analysis. So for instance, if the court said, all right, I think you get everything other than the visits or whatever, then he could have deducted the amount that was attributable to the visits, and we provided that, I believe, in Exhibit 338.
Where does the court's assessment of the credibility of the competing experts fit into this on appeal?
See, Your Honor, I would submit that this is not a battle of the experts, and the reason is that that on the material issues under the contract, the experts didn't disagree. And as an example, if you look at the capital cost allocation, there was no dispute that Section 2150 of the PRM sets forth how you should make that allocation. And it provides that if you must first allocate directly. Then if you can't, that is that you can't allocate directly, you allocate functionally. And if you can't allocate functionally, then you must use total cost as your allocation basis.
Well, and in what regard was the trial judge saying that your expert was not helpful or credible? Why did the judge say that?
Well, I think he said one is his articulated basis was that our expert took different positions in the court than he did before Hickford. But there is no evidence in the record that that's true. We pointed this out in our brief. Spherion did not contest it. I mean, in their answer brief, they didn't point this court to one place where our expert said something different in front of HICFA that he did in this trial court. We never contested the capital costs, the visits, the allocations of the medical supplies. You can read the position papers yourself. What happened here is we went in and we had a $40 million demand, and we were able to persuade one HICFA, first the fiscal intermediary, and then HICFA, either to change the adjustments or to re-audit and come up with different adjustments that brought that $40 million number down to $13 million. But within that $13 million, we didn't have any basis to contest liability. And we put into the record our own internal analyses of the settlement. And what we showed, we're going to lose on the capital costs. There's no basis. And I think that the court found that it was a battle of the experts because, again, it applied the wrong analysis. The court held that they were representing compliance with the regulations, the PRM, and the transmittals. And what the court allowed Spherion's expert to do and decided that Spherion's expert was persuasive was to say, well, I know that's what the PRM says, but they didn't have to comply with it.
Well, if this was not a battle of the experts, what is your position, that the court ruled contrary to all the experts?
Well, I think he ruled contrary to our best faith. In this instance, I mean, the court obviously spent a lot of time analyzing this, but I think it got a little off track where it recognized that what the representations and warranties were, but then allowed Sterion to argue that it didn't have to comply with the PRM. And I was saying, like, when the capital cost, for instance, what it boiled down to is everyone, their expert agreed that square footage was not a functional allocation in these circumstances. So he said, but they should have been allowed to use it because square footage is more equitable than what the PRM requires.
Well, rather than getting bogged down in the details, tell us whether your primary argument is a factual dispute or an issue of law, because as I understand, the focus of your argument is that we should apply the Third Circuit standards and that there was a reasonable basis for this settlement, and as a matter of law, you were entitled to indemnification, and that to the extent the court, the Superior Court, ruled that you should have gone forward and contested it, it misapplied the law.
That is clearly our first argument out of the box as a matter of law. But a second argument as a matter of law is that the court erred in its evidentiary analysis because it allowed Sterion to put in evidence, and its decision is based on the grounds that Sterion was entitled to ignore the PRM and the transmittals. And we submit as a matter of law, because of its contract representations.
So you're arguing in the alternative.
That's
exactly the same result.
Well, I didn't mean to talk over you. But not only in the alternative, but we need to get there for the benefit of the bargain damages. So yes, if you find for us on the first argument, I would submit we should be indemnified for the 5.2. But I would submit the court would then still need to look at the second issue to determine whether it should remand for the court to calculate benefit of the bargain damages. And on the issue of the, and just to I guess amplify on that issue, the damages question that I was being asked about, I would also want to emphasize to the court that we're entitled to 1997 damages because the 1996 cost report and all the bills for 1997 were submitted under Sterion's watch up until September of 1997. And there is no readjustment from September to December because you're just using the rates that are calculated in 1996. In other words, you submit your 1996 cost report. That establishes not only the final accounting for 1996, but it establishes what your rate is going to be for 1997, for the next year. Now, there's periodic adjustments to that, but those periodic adjustments all took place under Sterion's watch. So these were all cost reports and bills that were submitted, again, under its watch, which is why we should recover for 1997 as well. I would also address the issue.
Did you want to do that, you're into your rebuttal time?
Oh, I didn't realize I was. No, I will sum up at this point. Thank you.
Please, the court. Alan Terrell for Sterion. It's a complicated case below. It was a long trial, an even longer opinion, it seemed, to read and to fathom. There'll be a lot of issues raised by my friend on appeal that we probably will not have time to talk about today. I'll rely on my brief. Let me do two things. Let me address some of the points that Your Honor have raised with my friend and also try to put in perspective what I see as the legal issues. Certainly the underlying facts in dealing with Medicare procedures and regulations is complicated. But the issue that governed the case is whether or not the plaintiffs proved a breach of any representation and warranty in the agreement. The plaintiff's first argument that they made today goes directly to that point. They seem to argue that the fact of a settlement with the government proves both liability under the agreement and the entitlement to damages. Let me take them separately. The liability turns upon the language in the agreement. This agreement is different, for example, than the agreement in the Abex versus Wheelabrator case, where you could see in that agreement responsibility for the settlement about tax disputes and other issues, carefully provided for in that agreement. But here in this agreement, dealing with the sale of the health care division, it stated in section 10.1 that the indemnification from the seller to the buyer is based upon proof that there had been a breach of a representation and a warranty that caused damages.
Now, and while we're there, how does the distinction the Superior Court seemed to make between what was and was not notice from a governmental entity fit into this?
Your Honor, I think is going to the issue related to the notice provision and the notice in section 3.16. It fits into it because that is one of the representations and warranties as to which my friend's claim was breached. And if I may just turn directly to that point Your Honor has raised. Section 316A is where notice and the term NPR, a notice of program reimbursement, a, if you will, defined term in the Medicare world, appears. Section 316A really has three parts to it. Under Part 1, or Roman little I, it says that the seller states that there has been no appeal, if you will, of a notice program reimbursement, and no notices have been issued to the transferred entities. Cost reports. So what that really means is the seller is saying, look, I'm telling you there have been no notices of a cost report, audit, or challenge that have been issued and none have been appealed other than as shown on the schedule. And so in this case, the seller did in fact disclose the one NPR that had been issued at the time of closing, the NPR for the 1994 cost report. So in a nutshell, Your Honor, as to the argument that there has been a breach of the notice provision in section 316A, we submit that the appellants failed to meet the burden of proof. If I may follow up a little bit on that, the way in which the trial court got to that conclusion was really twofold. It applied a doctrine of the justum generis. In other words, that where the word notice follows from the more specifically, if you will, defined notice. In the you read it in the context. And certainly, looking at the agreement as a whole, looking at the Section 3 representations and warranties, the court made a reasonable interpretation that the word notices referred to NPR because it was in that phrase and in that context. Now, the second basis in which the trial court reached the conclusion that I believe is correct is that he pointed out that the word notices is then followed by the word issued. And issued is also has a more particular meaning in the Medicare world because it relates to the entity that actually issues or sends out a formal notice. It is not like saying, well, you had notice that there was such and such going on. It's a notice issued. And further in that same phrase, Your Honor, it references cost reports. So it has to be a notice that's issued that goes to cost reports. As of the time of closing, there had been only one NPR, and that was the NPR for the 1994 cost report.
Well, as you know, your opponent argues that the 96 and 97 problems occurred while your client was at the helm and therefore is responsible. I mean, why isn't that correct?
Let me, if I may, take the 97 point, one that's obviously not particularly in their brief and hasn't been pressed perhaps really until before Your Honor, though I believe they did make the argument below. It wasn't given much attention by the trial court because, frankly, it doesn't have any legs to stand on. And the reason is the 1997 cost report isn't filed until normally around April, May of the following year, because you, what happens is, Your Honors probably gather, is cost reports are filed by a provider like Interim that had 350 or so providing centers. They're filed during the course of the year in a form that is basically every 2 weeks. You put in the number of visits, and then you get reimbursed. The word cost report really refers to what's called a year-end cost report, the cost report that's filed for that calendar year. And that's not able to be put together, finalized by the provider until sometime in April, May. At least that's been the track record for Interim. So this transaction closed, as Your Honors know, at the end, really, of the summer of 1997. And at that point, yes, the health care business turned over to the plaintiffs. But that meant that you're more than 6 months thereafter before the 1997 cost report is filed. And there's really no basis to try to push that liability off on the seller. Now, as to the 1996 cost report, that was certainly an issue at trial and well addressed by the trial court. And yes, we believe that we have responsibility for the 1996 cost report. We filed it in April 1997, before the closing, before the agreement was entered into. And as that, we submit that there is no satisfactory proof, they have not met their burden of proof, that we breached any provision with respect to that cost report. Maybe I should pause and point out that it would seem to me that the trial court approached the agreement in the correct way that this court has explained that contracts like this should be looked at. That when you look at a contract that's reached between two sophisticated business entities and is the result of a process, in this case, an auction process with due diligence and with, if you will, experts on both sides, for purpose of the agreement, the court can properly say the agreement is read in terms of how it reads in its entirety, and you interpret it in its entirety. And the court properly, with respect to breach of contract or breach of warranty, did not consider extrinsic evidence and did not apply the plaintiffs, the appellants, extensive due diligence against the appellant with respect to the breach of warranty claims. And so we look to that agreement to see how the parties dealt with the cost reports. They're dealt with most directly, as Your Honor, I think, has pointed us to, 316 and 317. Now, 317 is actually where you see more reference to cost report. That is the provision called government filings. And that is the provision that says, and I would summarize it, but use the key language. That's the provision that says that the seller is representing and warranting that it's filed its cost reports in all material respects in compliance with the laws. And laws is a defined term in the agreement.
I don't want you to get sidetracked from your argument. Why don't you respond directly to this legal contention that we should apply the Third Circuit standard with regard to indemnification for settlements?
Right. But the simple and straightforward answer is you look to the agreement itself as to whether the parties provided for an automatic, if you will, indemnification for settlement. And so the answer to that is twofold. The agreement doesn't read that way, and certainly the conduct of the parties and the consent that Your Honor referred to in Mr. Hayes' remarks did not provide an agreement to assume responsibility for the settlement. And the reason here is, Your Honor, the word settlement, or the word damage in the agreement, does include settlement. So if they prove a breach, they are entitled to the settlement cost that are associated with that breach. So the fact of settlement doesn't prove a breach of the representation and warranty. And the fact of settlement alone and the dollar amount of settlement doesn't automatically entitle them to that full sum, because the breach and the actual damages have to be related.
This is referred to in the record as the trial within the trial.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Well, so what the trial court had to do here was to determine on its own whether or not the provider here, the defendant's 1996 cost reports, in all material respects, complied with the laws. And it had to make its own determination. It did not, and this is the trial within trial, I suppose, Your Honor, it did not say just because there were claims and it was settled, that isn't enough to find liability. And it makes sense, too, because, as Your Honor's noted, the settlement covers a five-year period, actually. Claims were asserted by the government against the appellants for 5 years of cost reports. Now, two of those years were when cost reports were done by my client, 94 and 96. But there's no liability for 94 because that cost report and the NPR was listed on the schedule to 316 in the agreement. So the agreement excludes liability on behalf of my client. That doesn't mean, of course, that the government can't proceed to collect on that cost report, the 94 cost report. And it obviously did, in fact, through the process that resulted in the settlement. But it just means that we have no responsibility for that.
Why isn't it a simple matter of probation, as your opponent suggested?
Well, it isn't, because in the first place, this was a compromise between the appellants and the government. The government originally sought a large amount. There is no way of knowing to which year or what claims the $5.2 million relates.
But as I understand it, there was $13 million of exposure that was settled for substantially less.
That sounds fine, Your Honor, yes.
And, you know, why isn't that enough to show that you had a reasonable basis for fearing a larger loss and the settlement was a good idea? A
couple reasons. In the first place, we looked at the agreement as to whether or not we are responsible for it. A clear reading of the agreement would say that the damages that they are entitled to have to have been caused by the breach, and so they have to be able to show the actual damages caused by the breach. So it's their responsibility to show what portion of that settlement fund is attributable to 1996. And as the trial court pointed out, they could have done that. They could have taken discovery from the government. They could have made their case that way. All they did was come up at trial with their own internal work paper, a work paper we didn't prepare, we didn't sign off on. The government didn't say that's a reasonable basis. Their own work paper they used to try to say this is how you allocate it. And now they come into court and say, well, what about $1 million? Maybe we can get that. A word on the $1 million, I think it relates to the settlement and damages, Your Honor. What happened was, after this investigation began in 1997 and 1998, the government started withholding, if you will, payment back to the provider, which was the appellant at that point, up to the amount of roughly $1 million. Now, that was never apportioned. It could have been applied to the 1994 cost report, could have been for 97, 98, or 96. There's no way of knowing. There's nothing in the record. So there's no way of saying that $1 million really should be attributable to the 1996 cost report. And even if it were, Your Honor, this agreement is interesting in terms of how the damages would be, if you will, be calculated. And I say that because the indemnification section, Section 10, goes on in Section 10.3 to have a threshold and a cap for damages except as to certain specified issues or claims. So in other words, the claim of the appellants has to come up to the threshold level of $2 million before they are entitled to indemnification. And it can't go, and my client is not liable beyond $25 million. So even if we skip by all the other objections I have on the $1 million, it still doesn't come up to the $2 million threshold. Now, that's as to, if you will, indemnification in general for a breach of the representation and warranty, which would apply to Section 3.17 for government filings and cost reports. Now, there is, my friends have argued, well, maybe our breach comes within 3.16. And as to that, they'd be right. There is no limitation on damages. There's no threshold. There's no cap. Well, 3.16 was the provision that was amended after the agreement was first signed in June, before closing, that came upon a, if you will, a fraud and abuse problem. One of the franchises in El Paso, Texas, had apparently been preparing false cost reports, and so there was a big investigation between our parties and the government that led to the amendment of Section 3.16, so that the 3.16 that is in the final agreement, the September agreement, the, if you will, operative agreement, has two parts, 3.16A and 3.16B. Both of those, or really both those parts, turn really on, if you will, an intentional wrong act by the seller. In A, it would be withholding information about NPRs. If you'd known NPRs had been issued or were on appeal, or you knew and said knew of threatened proceedings. And then in B, it was more specifically fraud and abuse. You've actually filed reports fraudulently or with an intent to file false reports. So as to that, we can see in this agreement a plan, if you will, to shift the responsibility on the seller if the seller has done something, if you will, fraudulently or wrongfully, intentionally wrongfully, with respect to cost reports. And as the trial court found after hearing all the evidence, there was no credible evidence of any intentional wrongdoing by my client, the seller.
Well, and the trial judge also said there was no evidence of fraud.
That's correct. That's correct. Your Honor asked an interesting question I'd like to address in a few remaining seconds, and that is, I'm apologizing, maybe it was Your Honor, Judge Ridgely. What about experts and the credibility of experts? How does that come into play here? It's very important because it has nothing to do with whether how to read the agreement. The court wouldn't consider expert testimony on that. But it was important for this court to have experts to help it understand the Medicare regulations, the filings done by interim, the position taken by the government. And the plaintiffs apparently felt it useful for Curtis. Curtis went in there and battled the government and came to the conclusion, it's in the record at the court's opinion at pages 94 and 95, why Curtis testified as he did, that there was no problem with what my client had done. Sorry to rush. Thank you, Your Honors.
Please, Mr. General.
Respond maybe staccato to some of the arguments. There was no money owed for 1994. It's absolutely clear in the record, and it's addressed in our brief. There was $1 million. There's no payback. There was $1 million owed for 1994. When they adjusted the 1994 cost report, interim just was not paid that $1 million. The NPRs that were withheld were specifically addressed to the 1996 cost report. For 1997, Spherion has still not addressed the fact that if in the 1997 cost report, after we bought the business, we went in and made all of the adjustments that would have been necessary to bring that their allocation methodologies into line with the Medicare requirements, we still would have owed, we would have owed millions of dollars, because we've been all, we paid all that money in 1997 based on the 1996 inaccurate cost reports. So if we did the 1997 cost report correctly, we would have owed all that money back then.
as a result of what occurred. That's a, it's a false issue. The argument that the settlement provision only applies if we show liability renders that provision surplusage, because if we show that they're liable, that, which is one of the other elements of damages, then we would be automatically entitled to the amount of the settlement. So therefore, it has to mean something more than simply, well, you get the amount you paid in settlement if you can show liability, because you would get that anyway. It's got to be read broad. The argument, there is no way we could have provided a better allocation, because the government is immune for subpoena. And but beyond that, the record is clear, the government would not allocate. They didn't put any more emphasis on one or the other. They just simply settled with us, as is reflected, because of our financial condition.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.